Welcome to the Scientist Podcast. On today's episode, we interview Beth and Sophia, who are ambassadors for the Scientist website. Beth and Sophia talk in the podcast about their roles as ambassadors and how COVID-19 has impacted their work and research.
I'm researching something called neurovascular dysfunction, which is basically to do with the brain and the blood vessels. And I'm looking at that in Alzheimer's disease.
In our group, we're doing drug design. So it's also quite relevant to, you know, these days now.
We hope you enjoy listening to the podcast. Thank you. So hello, how are you? Can you two start by introducing yourselves?
I'm Beth. I'm a first year PhD student at the University of Sheffield. So I'm really new to PhD research. I only started in October. But yeah, I'm researching something called neurovascular dysfunction, which is basically to do with the brain and the blood vessels. And I'm looking at that in Alzheimer's disease. We use lots of different techniques to try and figure out what's actually going on in the brain in Alzheimer's disease.
And I'm Sophia. I'm a third year PhD student, so finishing now. I'm in the University of Edinburgh, and in our group we're doing drug design, so it's also quite relevant to, you know, these days now. We're a computational chemistry group, so we're not at the lab at all. We're mostly in front of a computer programming, watching molecules interact with each other. And what I'm doing is that I derive parameters in order to represent the molecules to make like a good model out of what's happening in the reality. And B, I'm doing a bit of software development because our group has developed a molecular dynamics framework. So we're trying to build more features, incorporate like new force fields. So yes, I'm mostly doing that. And we're looking at the case of the HIV reverse transcriptase in order to test our models and to see that, you know, they actually work. We need some experimental data to compare them. So yes, this is more or less what I'm doing.
Okay, so I'll start with you, Beth. Beth, you explained in your research when there is an increased blood flow to the brain, neurons become ignited and they re-deliver oxygen and glucose to the brain, which leads to the phenomenon known as neurovascular coupling. Can you explain this phenomenon more?
Yeah, so I love that, the idea of neurovascular coupling, because it makes it sound super complicated, but actually it is quite a simple concept. So the point of neurovascular coupling is basically in the brain, it only really uses glucose. So you have your blood flow to the brain, which then brings about all the energy, so the oxygen and the glucose that it needs. And also the blood flow gets rid of toxins, so it can get rid of like little proteins that build up in the brain, and it can also get rid of carbon dioxide, which is can be deadly to the brain. So neurovascular coupling is basically this mechanism whereby when neurons fire, obviously in that brain area, they're using up all the energy and the oxygen. So then neurovascular coupling is where you get a huge increase in cerebral blood flow in that same area. So then it's re-giving the cells the oxygen and the glucose they need and then taking those things away. And what we found with lots of, like, my lab has researched neurovascular coupling for quite a few years now. And they found that in aging, it changes. And it's different from when you're younger to like as you grow up. And then we've also found that in neurodegenerative diseases, so things like Alzheimer's disease, uncoupling can happen. So basically when neurons fire, there's not as much blood flow in the brain. So we found that in Alzheimer's disease in patients and in preclinical models, there's actually reduced blood flow in the brain like early in the disease. So this is something that we're looking at and trying to figure out if this could be like a biomarker to see if we could maybe use it to like diagnose Alzheimer's disease a bit earlier, or if there's ways that maybe we could like try and increase blood flow to see how that may change the prognosis of Alzheimer's disease, basically.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I read somewhere that it's very important to use nutrients for producing waste and how we bring nutrients to increase and maintain neuronal activity. Do you know much about that, or is that what your research centres on?
So like I said, it's basically like the blood flow is really important for function. So say a stroke, for example, blood flow stops to the brain and brain cells can die because they don't get the oxygen they need, they don't get the energy they need to be able to perform like all of their functions. So if they don't get these, like the energy and the oxygen, and then they get the buildup of the toxins, it does mean that they're not going to work as well and that they can die. So that's the whole point of like neurovascular coupling, is the fact that like there is this mechanism where when your neurons start to fire in a certain region of your brain, that you get that blood flow to that same region. And basically, so fMRI machines, so they measure like, it's brain activity, but they basically measure like the blood oxygenation levels, so the changes in the blood oxygenation. So they don't actually measure neural activity that some people think it does. It's more like a bit of a proxy for it. It's like an indirect measure. And like fMRI machines kind of rely on the concept of neurovascular coupling. So they kind of assume that when neurons fire, there's an increase in blood flow. So that's why it's also really important to research neurovascular coupling, because one, it's important in disease, and then two, it can be important in interpreting accurately findings from fMRI studies.
Okay, that's brilliant. Moving on to you, Sophia, your work primarily concerns the use of theoretical models to understand small active molecules that can be used as drugs, known as computer-aided drug design. Can you expand more on this?
Yeah, so let's look at the process of making a drug, for example, okay? You have a protein that might be, for example, bad for your health, because it might be in a virus or in an organism that harms your body. So what we need to do is stop this protein from working. In order to do so, we're taking small ligands, the small molecules, they're called ligands, that can enter the protein, find the active site of the protein, and inhibit it. Okay, so we're trying to find the best candidate for this small molecule, the one that will inhibit the specific protein, but not other proteins that might be helpful for your body, right? Mm. So these candidates can be thousands. So we want to end up with some, like, let's say 5 or 10, so that the chemist can actually make them in the lab and then test whether these work. So using some computational techniques that are called molecular dynamic simulations or other features, let's say, or other other computational techniques, we can measure the binding energy, for example, of the ligand in the protein. We can measure energies, we can measure distances, and decide which molecule, let's say, is the best candidate for the inhibition of the protein.
Okay, that's brilliant. What are the benefits associated with computer-aided drug design?
I think it is that they reduce a lot the time and the money that we can spend during the drug design process, because you cannot actually test every single molecule, go to the lab and, you know, synthesize it, because that would take billions of dollars. Computational chemistry actually helps you to decide which one is the best candidate in order to go on and proceed with this one. And also keep in mind that, you know, this whole process from the beginning until, you know, having a vaccine or a medicine can take up to 13 years, and it can cost billions of dollars. Computational chemistry helps in the first, in the initial steps of this process, and tries to reduce, you know, this amount of time and of money.
Okay, that's brilliant. So how do you believe computer-aided drug design can help with the COVID-19 epidemic?
I'm glad you asked, because I'm also involved in a project about COVID-19 right now. COVID-19 has this spike protein that actually helps the virus bind, let's say, on the human body. And what we're trying to do is inhibit the specific spike protein. So it's not just computational chemists that have a lot of work to do right now. It's biologists, it's chemists all around the world that are trying to find which is the best way to deal with this new pandemic and with this virus.
Okay, brilliant. So now a question for both of you. You're both passionate about getting deprived communities to engage in STEM. Can you explain more where this passion comes from?
I think It's just more like, for me, I think like science should be for everyone. Like, I don't think it should matter where you're from or like where you were born or who you are. It's if you're interested, you should be able to do it. And I think it's good that there's quite a few like charities which help this. So like I'm like a member of something called the Brilliant Club, and their thing is where they want to try and get kids from who are underrepresented at university. So it's more like people who are underrepresented at like Russell Group universities. Mm. So they have this scheme where PhD tutors, who I'm like one of them, I've not been able to go and do it yet because of COVID. I was just about to start my thing in school before COVID, so we're trying to rearrange that. But basically they have tutors who go into schools, and kids from certain state schools come to the university nearish them, and they go and look around, and then you basically teach them tutorials of like a project booklet. It might be on your PhD research, or it might be a booklet made by someone else about some form of STEM. And then towards the end of it, they write like a big like a 2,000 word article, and it just gives them the skills that are needed at university, which aren't really taught at secondary school. So yeah, it just gives them a bit of an edge to like give them a better chance to get there. And like for me, I went to a really good state school, to be honest, but I know some aren't as good as others. And I would hate to think that just because of where I came from, I wouldn't be able to do something that I was interested in and something that lots of people can excel at. Like STEM is for everyone, and that should be made apparent, like wherever.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Beth. And also I want to add that, you know, sometimes people think that science is something really distant and that it doesn't concern them. So that's why it's really important to reach out to these people and, you know, show them that, first of all, science is not difficult. You can understand it with really easy concepts, and, you know, it's everywhere around you. And about reaching to like more to people who don't have this privilege to be well educated, I think it's also really important. And from my side, what we did during the pandemic was that we developed, first of all, it started as a group chat in WhatsApp that is called Scientist Next Door. But then we expanded to have like a whole website where we're actually connecting scientists with families and with children. And we're organizing Zoom calls or Skype calls, and we're talking about science, and we're also doing some, you know, small and simple experiments. But you see, you know, their enthusiasm and how much they love learning about this kind of stuff. And, you know, it's a really nice feeling. It's really promising seeing all these new people, the new generation, being really interested in science.
How do you feel that it's the process as being a woman in science, for example?
So for me, I come from a psychology background, so that's actually mainly female, like female dominated. I think on my undergrad we had about, there's about 200 students, and probably like six of them were male. So wow. For me, I'm coming from a completely opposite side of what some STEM subjects are. I actually did my undergrad dissertation on the experience of females in STEM, in male-dominated STEM courses, and I did like engineering, computer science, and I found that really interesting to see how their experiences were really different to mine. They said that in the university environment it was all fine, there was little bits of issues here and there, but it was more like when they went to like construction sites, stuff like that, that's when like sexism was kind of apparent. But they did find that their experiences like made them quite resilient, which was really nice to hear. So for me, I've never really had any issues, but I do know it happens, and I think it's important to acknowledge that just because I've never had any issues doesn't mean that they don't exist, because obviously yeah, they do. So it's important for like women to like share their experiences and other people to listen to them. And I think it's good to get like young people interested from a young age. I think that's the thing, like women are clearly interested in these things, it's just there's obviously more barriers at times. It's about like making sure the pipeline isn't leaky, as it's like been referred to in the literature.
Yeah,
I think as a female it is important to make sure that like you're making it accessible and you're like talking about your experiences if you feel comfortable doing that.
And I think it's really important to have women role models. So that's what I was lacking, because I studied applied maths and physics at the National Technical University of Athens. And out of my 58 modules that I had, probably only 7 or 8 were taught by women. So, you know, you could definitely see the difference there. So about the students, though, I think that we were like around 40, 60, but this is like a new generation thing. I think that like the previous generation, this is what it was lacking. It was lacking women in science, women in STEM. And I think this is also depicted in, for example, science publications, in science magazines. We see, I don't know, like probably the majority of the articles out there come out of male PIs and men in general. So you see that women are really poorly represented there, and this should definitely change. Definitely. And I hope it will change in the future. But
definitely, yeah. I think we've talked about this a lot on Scientists, the lack of representation of ethnic minorities and women of colour and just women in general in the sciences. And I think it's a really important issue. So I'm glad you guys could contribute on that. So slightly different question. How has COVID-19 impacted your ability to conduct research?
I was quite lucky, to be honest, because as I told you, I'm doing computational chemistry, so I'm just working in front of a computer. So I just moved everything home and I'm working like 100% from home. I had my projects plus the COVID-19 project, so I would say days were busier than they used to be. Yeah. And also, you know, since you're home all day, every day, I got into this like trap of working 7 days a week, you know, without properly having breaks, and that was really bad for me. But I couldn't understand that I was doing this because more or less each day was the same, and sometimes I was also feeling guilty that, you know, I was just like sitting there not working. So yeah, at some point I decided that I just need to devote some time for myself as well and have like proper breaks, because you cannot just work all day long for like 7 days a week. Yeah. So I think that in general, it had ups and downs. There were like days where I was really productive. There were other days where, you know, I couldn't concentrate. So yeah, but in general, I think I was luckier than other people. I've got a lot of friends in my department who are like proper chemists, that's how I call them. And they couldn't do any work because they're like mostly working from the lab. So they just had to stop everything, probably, you know, starting writing their thesis or studying more, reading papers, but that wasn't easy for them.
Yeah, I completely like resonate with what Sophia says about like the productivity. That's what's been quite difficult. So for me, because I'm a first year, like a lot of my first year is about learning specific techniques, like experimental, and then being able to like do the experiments on my own. Like I do experiments, I do them in the lab. So obviously because of COVID, we stopped going into the lab probably quite early March. Our university was quite strict on that, which is really good. So I've not been into university since like the beginning of March. Mm. I'd got experiments planned. They're meant to start in July, but obviously I was meant to be doing like skills for them. Yeah. I'm going to be a bit behind, and that's okay. I think one thing that has come from it is it's made me have time to sit down and like do my lit review. Because at my university, by the end of the first year, you need to have your lit review done, basically. Mm. Which I think is a good way of getting like the knowledge down. I think for you to be able to do your experiments, you need to have done your lit review and have your aims and your hypotheses. Yeah, I've actually had to sit down and do that. I've managed to send like a full draft to my supervisors, so I was quite pleased with that. I've also been able to take part in a review about dementia and animal models of dementia. And like comorbidity, so like more than one disease at once. So that's been quite good. I wouldn't have had probably a chance to do that. But yeah, when you're talking about like feeling that you've got to work 7 days a week, so obviously I kept my research like Mondays to Friday. I didn't work weekends because I thought if I start off working weekends, you'll never stop. Mm. I understand that at times I will have to work weekends, that's fine, but I didn't want to start doing that. So obviously I didn't work from home ever. So I had to completely change the way I worked, and it meant that I was doing quite long days, especially when I was writing. But I've started to make sure I'm a bit more strict with myself and giving myself my weekends off, because you can't be productive all the time. And then like, if you don't have a productive day, like realizing that that's not something to feel guilty about, you just need to kind of say to yourself, well, I'm not being productive today. There's probably no point in me doing it and then making myself feel guilty. So take the day off and then start again fresh tomorrow. So that's what I try and do. But yeah, it's been a learning curve, but I think what's kind of like nice about it, if you can say anything's nice about it, is everyone's in the same boat.
Yeah.
So a lot of people you can talk to. I think like academic Twitter has been quite good to like talk about things, and the scientist community have been really good. Like people have been sharing their experiences, so you don't feel alone, which has been really nice and it's been really helpful.
That's really inspiring. I mean, I totally resonate with everything both of you are saying about trying to work all day, because you feel guilty when you don't work all day.
Especially when you're at the end of your PhD, where you feel like, oh, I need to write up and I need to like finish everything. So yeah, you know, seeing the time passing so fast, you have this impression that you're not going to make everything that you have in your mind. So yeah. Probably that's why you panic and you just panic work all day.
It's called high functioning. That's what I've been told. It's called being high functioning. Okay, so final question for both of you. What golden piece of advice would you give to try and get more women and people from deprived communities, ethnic minorities into science?
Yeah, I would say that if they want to do it, then they can do it. They shouldn't listen to people saying that I don't know, like women are not smart enough for science or anything. If you're determined, then go for it.
Yeah, I completely like resonate with everything Sophia said. I think science is for everyone, no matter who you are, like male or female, ethnic minority. It should be for everyone, and I think it's important to remember that it's more difficult for certain individuals because of their backgrounds, and stuff should be put into place to help that. And I think universities are trying to do things like that with the movement at the moment. But I think a lot more needs to be done. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's just knowing that it doesn't matter who you are, like if you want to do STEM, do it. And as long as like you work hard and people are there to support you, I'm sure you'll do a pretty good job and you'll probably get to where you want to be.
That's brilliant. Well, we love having you ambassadors, and it's brilliant having you on the podcast. Really, it is. Thank you for listening. I've been Mariam.
I've been Beth.
I've been Sophia.
You have been listening to Scientist. Check out our podcast here on Anchor FM and Spotify, or follow us on scientist.net/podcast every Wednesday. Thank you for listening.